This Week in Retronauts, it's like Atari 2600, but three times over. Everyone, welcome to another Retronauts episode. I am Jeremy Parrish, and with me here to follow up on our Midwest Gaming Classic, or yes, that's what it's called, Midwest Gaming Classic panel, Atari Got a Raw Deal. Here are two guys who are going to talk about the Atari 7800. Why don't you introduce yourselves?
I'm Kevin Bunch. I do the YouTube series Atari Archive.
And you were on the panel. You were a panelist.
I was indeed a panelist.
Yes, and as I said at the panel, the idea of your Atari 7800 collecting inspired me to want to do a panel on Atari 7800, but then I realized that might not be the most exciting topic for a live panel at a show like this. So I changed it up, but I do want to talk about the 7800, and that's why you're here. And also here is...
I'm Brian Clark. I am a translator who tries as often as he can to write about different game and game culture things. Often Japanese related, so I may be a bit of a weird pick for a podcast about
what
Atari.
What are you doing here?
We'll find out.
Okay, that's good. Well, I'm sure both of you know more than I do about the 7800. I have very little experience with the system. As I said to the panel, like I had very little awareness of the 7800 back when it was alive. I never saw ads for it. I saw it in the stores, but not knowing the history of it or its provenance, I just assumed it was, you know, an Atari system from a long time ago that I'd never seen before. And so, you know, when it came to buying video games, I was like, well, NES is new. What's a 7800? This must be ancient. But that's not really the case, is it? Is it now?
No, not at all.
So why don't you give us the history of the Atari 7800? You seem to know a lot about it.
Yeah, it was actually one of the first game systems I had when I was a kid. So it came out in May 1986, or thereabouts, after being shelved for 2 years due to some legal issues that...
Well, you're kind of burying the lead there. It was designed in 1984.
Yes.
Or to be released in 1984, so it had been around for a while.
That's true.
Yeah. So this system has some heritage, and kind of the one of the premises of our panel today was that Atari probably deserved for the 7800 to perform better, but it was just kind of buried.
Yeah. So to talk about the 7800, you have to jump back a bit to talk about the 5200 and the Mattel Intellivision. Basically, Mattel released the Intellivision console in 1979, and they ran an ad campaign competing directly with the Atari 2600, pointing out how much better their games were. Pretty much every respect, you know, they had better animation. As you said in the panel earlier, lifelike animation was their exact terminology. Right. They had better graphics. It was a 16-bit console, had a more advanced controller with all sorts of buttons and a keypad and a...
So when you say 16-bit console, how did that manifest in the nature of the games and then the stuff you saw? Because it seems really on par with the NES in terms of power.
Yeah, it's hamstrung elsewhere. I'm not too familiar with the Intellivision specs, but it was technically the first 16-bit console, so it's got that going for it.
Oh, right. Sorry, you were talking about Intellivision. I spaced out. I thought you were talking about 7800. Yeah,
no, we're getting there.
Intellivision was 16-bit, but it was, you know, like there's only so much
you can
at a
do.
Certain speed. Yeah, like... Yeah, and you had stuff like the TI-99/4A, which was a 16-bit computer and the first of those, but like it had things hamstringing it. Yeah,
it was no Genesis, but... So Atari responded by developing the 5200 as sort of their follow-up console, and then when that finally did launch in 1982, it came out against the ColecoVision, which had just gotten announced that year and came out around the same time, a little bit earlier, I think. And the Intellivision was the much more the ColecoVision was the much more popular console between the two. I think it outsold the 5200 like 2-to-1 or somewhere around there.
It's that power supply, man.
Yeah, it has this giant power supply. You could kill someone with it.
I used to own a ColecoVision, and I don't remember the power supply. How big was it?
Yeah, it's
For those of us at home, that was the size of a small dog, basically.
it's sizable. But so the ColecoVision was outselling the 5200. Atari kind of figured they'd screwed up here, and they started polling people in 1983, like, well, what would you like to see in a future Atari console? Well, we want to see backwards compatibility out of the box. We want better visuals. We want more in-depth experiences. We want better arcade ports. So they, you know, took all of this to General Computing Corporation, which was sort of this weird little, I guess you'd call them like a rebel studio. They released a ROM hack for Missile Command in the arcade, and they actually were the people who designed Ms. Pac-Man.
Yeah, I mean, they had quite a legacy, and Ms. Pac-Man was definitely probably the biggest thing they did up until that point. It's interesting, though, that you know, given Atari's kind of sideways relationship with Namco dating back into the 70s, that they would reach out to the company that basically hacked Namco and outdid Namco at their own game to design their game hardware.
Yeah, I'm just going to go purely anecdotal here, but I know Namco was also in with the Yakuza in distributing bootlegs of Atari games in Japan, so
No love lost, basically.
No love lost. I don't know how familiar the U.S. Atari office was about that by 1983, but I would like to draw a line between the two. But yeah, they apparently went to court with GCC about Missile Command, and I think this led to them having this sort of development relationship. GCC did some Atari 2600 ports for them that were actually really spectacular. Like, they did Ms. Pac-Man, they did Moon Patrol, they did Galaxian, Junior Pac-Man. So I guess they just decided, you know, these folks can work on developing this next console. So they designed the system around the system shell that Atari had already put together for the Japanese Atari 2600 release.
You mean the 2800?
Yes, the 2800, which came out in 1983 and was a spectacular failure.
Yeah, it took 6 years for that system to come out in Japan, and it came out concurrently with the Famicom, the NES, and the SG-1000, which was basically a ColecoVision. So, like, why even bother? And Atari had a Japanese division for a long time. That's like that's how they had a relationship with Namco. So there's all kinds of weird stuff that, you know, when you start looking back into history, you're like, I don't understand how these things happened like this. Did they really not parlay their relationship with, you know, with Atari Japan into bringing their console a lot sooner? But it is a nicely designed console. Like, Japanese console aesthetics tend to be really nice, less boxy and clunky than American console aesthetics. So, yeah, the 7800 looks good.
Yeah, it looks pretty sleek for mid-1980s design. And so they had to design the system to fit within this system shell. So they only had so much room to work with. They crammed in a TIA chip so that they could run Atari 2600 hardware or software on there, and controllers and all that fun stuff.
By that point, the 2600 internals had probably been miniaturized to the point that it was no big deal.
Yeah, I mean, it's a 6502 variant, so it had been around since the mid-70s. Nothing new there. It had a custom graphics chip, the Maria. It had a pretty decent CPU.
The interesting thing about the Maria chip is that it's clocked really fast. It's clocked to 7.16 megahertz, which I realize is not that fast by contemporary standards. It's like a million times slower than gigahertz, so like 1,000 times slower than your current computer. But at the time, that was really fast.
Yeah, and actually
much faster than the actual chip.
Yeah, and actually the TIA chip they put in there is actually interesting, because you know, it works as the 7800 and the 2600 CPU. And because Atari had such issues with third parties just releasing whatever they wanted on the 2600, they designed a security lockout code for the 7800. So if it didn't read that code, it would boot into 2600 mode and the CPU would be clocked down to run 2600 games properly. But if it did find that code, it would run the 7800 mode and it would be faster and you'd have full access to its capabilities.
Was that backward compatibility completely enabled through CPU clocking?
I think so. I don't think they...
Interesting.
I don't think they did anything else. Like, it's all internal right there. And
so the 7600 or 7800 really is like just three 2600s, basically.
Yeah, just tape them together. It's like a couple of Wii's, make a Wii U.
I've heard that, yeah.
But it's pretty cool. And, you know, they advertised that the system could move around like almost 100 sprites independently. I think there's actually some limitations on that, but that's still a lot without having any flickering at all.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't have any limitations with scan lines or anything, right?
I mean, it has a couple of resolution modes, if that's right. What you mean.
No, so scan lines, you know, with the NES hardware, basically you can only have 8 sprites per line, like horizontal line on the system, so on the screen. So that's what I mean by scan lines. Like when you get more than 8 sprites on a line on the NES, that's when you get the flicker. But if it doesn't have the scan line issues, you said there's no flicker on 7800.
Yeah, I've never noticed any on any of the real sprite intensive games like Robotron or Food Fight or anything of that sort.
But it is a 6502 variant, right?
Yes.
So it's running on the same fundamental tech as the NES. So
yes.
It's interesting. I guess that's where the graphics chip comes into play, you know, because it's clocked so fast, it probably can handle a lot more at a, you know, per instruction cycle.
Right.
But so that's actually really interesting.
But the big weakness of the system is that they didn't have room to put in a specific sound chip in there, so it just has to use the TIA 2600 chip as like its onboard audio. So what they did is they included a specific line on the cartridge port so that you could have on cartridge sound chips. Like you could have Atari had their Pokey chip, which is what they used in a lot of their arcade hardware. It's what they used in their 5200 and their computer line. GCC was developing a Gumby sound chip that, I don't know how far along that got, but it never actually reached production. It was supposed to be the low-cost alternative. I want to say there's been some like recent homebrew activity looking at the possibility of having like a Yamaha FM synth chip on there. So it's
that'd be kind of amazing, actually.
Yeah, and
it'd be like my 7800 is suddenly a Sega Genesis.
And it gets more interesting because they also designed the system to be expandable elsewhere. Like they had an expansion slot on their original design, and you see it on the very first run of 7800s. And that was intended to plug in a Laserdisc attachment for the machine. And you know, they had a keyboard component that they were going to release that would basically put it on par with their 8-bit computer line. You'd be able to use like a trackball or the joystick as your mouse, basically. And they had a high score cartridge too that never made it to production, but there's a prototype and people have reproduced it.
So what would the idea there be? Like you hot swap or something?
No, it's even more interesting. It's a pass-through cartridge.
Okay.
Like Sonic 3 and Knuckles.
Lock-on technology.
It's lock-on technology, and it's a battery back save in 1984. And this would work with the first run of games that GCC was developing for the system. So you can plug that in to your 7800, you plug the cartridge on top of that, and it'll save your high scores. Like, you type in your name and everything.
There's so much wild tech that was being developed at Atari back in those days. Like, it's just, I always hear about stuff, and I'm just like, wow, that was so sophisticated, so far ahead of its time. But, you know, it was kind of tied to the 2600 hardware, which just wasn't, like, it was, you know, it did its thing in its time, but it aged pretty quickly in the 80s. So it's kind of hard to look back, you know, go back and really enjoy a lot of these things that were created for the 2600. But there was so much innovation. It's interesting that you know, even carried forward into the 7800.
Yeah, and it's kind of interesting because, you know, a while back I was speaking with one of the engineers who designed the 2600, and he talked about how when they were developing the system, they put together this cartridge port, and he said that they cut down the number of lines to save on money, but had those extra connectors, you know, you could have had much more expansive carts. You could have included all this hardware without all the weird bank switching meddling that they ended up having to do in the early 80s just to keep expanding the capabilities of the machine. And he said it would have made it much easier to sort of make it forward looking.
Mm-hmm. So it's another case of Atari got a raw deal where, like, just if things had turned out a little differently, what could the 7800 have been?
Yeah.
Like, could it have, you know, been a proper successor in terms of market share to the 2600? Could it have, you know, continued to carry forward Atari's mind share? It's such an interesting piece of hardware that it really makes me wonder what might have been.
Yeah, and it's really it's kind of unfortunate because they had all of these plans for it. It was going to come out in 1984, I think in the summer was when they were advertising it, first going on the market. And by that point, you had this, you know, major tech industry collapse. Businesses didn't want to really parlay video games anymore. So Atari was hemorrhaging money, like we talked about in the panel earlier. Mm. You know, Warner was thus hemorrhaging money, and they ended up selling all of their consumer division bits and pieces and IPs to the Jack Tramiel.
Yeah, Atari was in the middle of a massive restructuring and split at the time. Warner was in no position to launch new hardware. The market was in no position to accept new hardware. Like, even if retailers had been like, yay, new video game hardware, like, there was still so much unsold software in the channel that they couldn't take it. There was no bandwidth for it, unless they just went out and destroyed all the carts that they had, which I'm sure eventually happened, but it took longer, and no one was really in a hurry to do that. So, yeah, there was just, like, things could have been so good for the 7800 if it had launched when it did, or when it was meant to, but it didn't work out.
No, and not only... So Tramiel bought all of this Atari materials, and he, like, picked up the debt of the consumer division, which he had to pay off over so many years. But that did not include the 7800, as it turned out. He thought it did, GCC thought it did, but Warner had a contract with GCC for the 7800. They refused to pay it. They said, nope, it's Tramiel's problem now. Tramiel was insistent that it was Warner's problem. GCC wanted Warner to pay, but eventually they're like, you know, as long as we get our money, you can have this. So in late 84, he finally just bit the bullet and paid for the 7800 hardware, but then he didn't have any software, because GCC had developed all of these, like, launch games. So then they had to figure out terms to pick that up. And it wasn't until around November 1985 or thereabouts when they finally got all that settled and they could finally release this system that he'd been sitting on. And they knew that the video game market was still there and it was still viable because, I mean, they had sold over, like, 1,000,600 units in 1985 alone. And that's including, you know, old video game stock on top of that. So there was still an appetite for this stuff. Mm.
So do you think they were aware of the NES, like, soft launch in October of 1985? Because that took place at, like, two retailers in New York City. So it's not exactly, like, something that was making headlines, but I feel like, you know, this is a pretty big deal. Like, this is a big Japanese player making its test launch in America. Surely out in California, the Tramiels would be like, They were based in California, right?
I think so.
Not Chicago?
I'm not 100% sure, so I can't tell you for sure.
But still, not New York.
Not New York, no.
And I mean, wasn't there a story, and I don't know how true this is, but wasn't there a story where during that soft launch, like one of the first people who came to buy all the NES stuff was someone from Sega? So, I mean, if that's true, then it's not unfathomable that someone from Atari could know about it at that point as well.
Yeah, I mean, I had not heard that. It does sound like a slightly odd story since... you know, Sega being a Japanese company would have had easy access to like all those games. You know, several of them were a couple of years old at that point. So I don't know why that would happen aside from just, you know, the general inability that Sega has always had for its US and Japanese arms to work together and collaborate and, you know, try to win. So it's hard to say who could say, but I definitely think Sega would probably have been, you know, had more of a pulse on what Nintendo was doing, especially since Sega was looking to do the same thing as Nintendo and enter the American market. But
and
I don't know. It's speculation.
And Nintendo did look into partnering with Atari to sell the Famicom in the U.S. in 1983, and it just kind of got lost in the shuffle when, you know, Warner was losing all their money and Tramiel was purchasing, he's getting the consumer division. So they just kind of lost track of that, and Nintendo just said, screw it, we're going to publish this ourselves. And I don't know if they would have shelved the Famicom or the 7800, or if they would have put them both out and just marketed them to different audiences, but either way, it probably didn't work out for them that Nintendo went on their own.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine the Atari family computer being, you know, a runaway success. It just doesn't seem like Atari would have put their hearts into it. It wasn't something they created, and I think unless they could have completely owned it from top to bottom, I don't think it would have appealed to them.
Yeah. The 7800 did finally make it out in 1986. Atari didn't really have that much money at the time, but you know, they launched it. The GCC games that they developed, they were mostly early arcade ports, since, you know, it was supposed to come out in 1984. So stuff like Galaga and Zevius and Food Fight and Robotron, those would have been not quite contemporary, but they would have been new enough for that to be
relatively fresh. Yeah,
yeah, it would have been pretty good. In 1986, it's a little long in the tooth. That said, they did have the first U.S. releases of Galaga and Zevius, and, well, Food Fight, I think, only ever came out on that and their computer line.
Yeah, you know, I think it's interesting that if you look at Nintendo's launch lineup, when they did their soft launch in October of 1985, the games that they released did not include any of their arcade hits. Popeye, Donkey Kong, Donkey Kong Jr. Those didn't make it out until the following year. Mario Brothers also. Those didn't come until mid-1986. Because I think they recognized, like, it's not really putting our best foot forward. Like, these are games that, you know, people like, but they're not going to make the most amazing impression because they are 3 or 4 years old, or 5 years old in the case of Donkey Kong. So they had that luxury because Nintendo had so much first-party development in Japan, whereas Atari did not have that luxury. It was pretty much just like, well, here's Zevius. It's 4 years old, but what are you going to do?
But if you are the type of person who cares about this sort of thing, in my opinion anyway, they were almost universally, with one notable exception, pretty clearly superior to any of the ports that have appeared on the Famicom or any other system up until that point.
So what would the one exception be?
The one exception is Double Dragon. I spent a non-insignificant time of my life playing and writing about games in the beat-em-up genre, or whatever you want to call it. And I think if you're not including the 2600 version of Double Dragon, which you almost shouldn't, the 7800 version for when it came out is absolutely awful. It has a rendition of the Double Dragon theme that is played just slow enough that makes me feel like I'm going insane.
So I don't know that Double Dragon's really germane to this conversation, though.
It's not.
That was a 1987 arcade game, it was a much later release on all systems. But you know, looking back to the early 80s sort of golden age classics, that's kind of what 7800 was leaning on. Are you really sure that every one of those games was superior to the Famicom version, the NES version? Like I think Galaga and Zevius are pretty damn good on NES.
I think Zevius on 7800 had a less grating sound.
Huh. Okay.
It was.
It's I don't know how to explain. It's very tinny on the NES.
A lot of those early NES arcade ports, no matter how good they felt in your hands, I feel like had music that was slightly tinny. I feel like that wasn't all that uncommon for like the 1984 era kind of Famicom arcade ports.
And, you know, those didn't come out in the U.S. until, you know, 87, 88.
Yeah. So maybe that's why Namco ended up creating its own sound chip for the Famicom. It couldn't get the sound it wanted from Nintendo's built-in hardware, so who knows?
Yeah.
Okay, so
knows?
So you're mostly going on audio quality as opposed to like the play mechanics or the visuals.
I think the visuals, you're kind of splitting hairs a little bit. I feel like with Zevius specifically, I feel like if you put them side by both of the versions side by side with the arcade, you might feel like the 7800 looks a little bit closer, even though it's still not quite on the nose, but it's not so dramatic to say the 7800 version is unequivocally better, I suppose.
Okay. And fair enough.
And Galaga, I mean, it doesn't look as good as the NES one, but I mean, it plays all right.
Yeah. And yeah, like like you said, the NES version of that wouldn't ship until 88. So, at the time, yeah, I guess I could see where the 7800 at launch would basically be like, hey, it's the golden age all over again, which I don't know that anyone was necessarily looking for at the time, but it does make it something kind of valuable in retrospect. You know, it's like, here are some really great arcade conversions, you know, contemporarily, which you really had to look to PCs to find that a lot in the 80s. And not all PCs, just some PCs. Some PCs you wanted to avoid.
Oh, you're talking about the ZX Spectrum.
I'm not naming any names. We're all friends here.
7800, I think it actually sold reasonably well when it came out. Atari announced that they had shortages on their equipment, which, you know, they claimed they had going on with the Lynx too, but it sounded like they sold through their initial supply of 7800s and they had to make more of them. So it had that going for it, and you know, they only had so many games available and they had to sort of jumpstart development again and build their capability back up. So they kind of spaced out their first run of games. I mean, they were all finished in 85 when they got the rights to them, but you know, they spaced them out over the year. Like Zevius came out in November, a couple of the other ones came out over the summer. But then you just had this like 9-month drought between Zevius and Choplifter in 87. And, you know, Atari didn't have the availability to get all these popular games. They couldn't license them because Nintendo had already snapped all that stuff up. So they were kind of stuck with whatever was still free for them, which was mostly computer games and whatever they came up with themselves.
They certainly weren't the only occupants in that boat in the 80s. Sega had the same problem and found that it had a lot of problems with licensing. And Sega's solution was they would get the licenses, but the companies that made the games couldn't do the conversions. They couldn't, like, they were committed to create their games exclusively for Nintendo. So what they ended up doing was just Sega would go in and develop the conversions themselves, which is why you have Sega developing stuff like Strider and Super Ghouls and Ghouls and Ghosts. It's not Ghouls Super and Ghouls and Ghosts. Yeah, like, those are Sega-developed games, because even into the early 90s, Nintendo still had that hammerlock on the market and on third parties. But it sounds like Atari didn't have the bandwidth to do that. Like, Sega was a development company, so that's what they did. They made video games, and Atari was a lot of things, and specifically Atari Inc., or Atari Corporation, was not a software company. It was very much a hardware company.
Yeah, and you know, after the split of Atari's arcade division and their home division, they no longer had access to all the latest Atari arcade games, and they could just bring those to their hardware. You know, they had to go and make licensing agreements, which I think is what they did with the Lynx, mostly. Mm-hmm. That's how they got stuff like SnowRunner on there. But they didn't have that option for the 7800. Well, I guess they did have the option, they just didn't necessarily have the money to do it.
Right, yeah, there's, in some respects, there's a wider library of Atari games on NES, like when you start looking at Tengen stuff, than there is on Atari's own platforms. And that's kind of rough. That's got a sting.
It's a little pitiful.
Yeah.
So you see a lot of computer ports, like one-on-one basketball, a choplifter, some interminable flight simulators that were produced by third parties later on. And a lot of these they had to outsource to other companies because they just didn't have the people in-house to be able to do this stuff at the time, which is why you get stuff like from Ibid Corporation. They did Choplifter and Karateka, and they programmed these apparently in Forth, which I guess is kind of an older programming language even by that point.
Forth.
Is that related to Fortran?
I'm not sure. But apparently I can't target that as to why their ports are kind of janky, but they're janky.
Not exactly running on Unreal Engine 4.
No.
No. Unreal Engine 4th, maybe. Sorry.
I'm trying to imagine what that would be. I'm sure it would be amazing.
Yep, it's the greatest programming language that an engine that 1985 has to offer. So they had those. I mean, they were able to get some arcade ports up there. They got Hat Trick, which is an arcade game I don't think anybody cared about. So they were able to get that going.
Not to be mistaken for Hatris.
No, no one could get Hatris yet. It was too good.
Yeah, that's the problem.
they had Hat Trick. I'm not entirely sure how they finagled it. But they did publish their own version of Donkey Kong, Donkey Kong Jr., and Mario Brothers.
That must have been some sort of holdover license or something from the previous Atari consoles.
That's the only thing I can think
of.
Or
they just said, the hell with it, Nintendo can't stop us. We're Atari, damn it. Who are these upstarts?
But what's baffling about the Donkey Kong ports is that they didn't seem to base them off of the arcade game. They seem to have based them off the NES ports.
Really?
Yeah, so Donkey Kong and Donkey Kong Jr. basically look like the NES games. They have the same, like, title screen songs. Just much worse, because they're using a 2600 audio chip.
Huh.
And they don't have the missing level from Donkey Kong NES.
That's, I think, very, you're strange. Understating how off the music is and that Donkey Kong port too.
It's a little screechy.
So these are official releases, like licensed from, yes, Atari releases, not third party or not like bootleg releases or aftermarket releases.
Oh, they came out from Atari. We bought them at the store when I was a kid.
Huh. That's, yeah, I can't begin to explain that, but okay. Stuff happens.
I will say Mario Brothers, I think Atari did a better job with it. It's a more fun game because it's not as slippery.
Hmm. Well, even Nintendo went back and redid. They took a mulligan on Mario Brothers. There's a version that was released in Japan and Europe called Mario Brothers Returns. Mm. Kaiketai.
Kaiketai.
Yep. And It's a much better version. It's still slippery, but looks more like the arcade game. Like, the fighter flies aren't two sprites constantly flickering with every frame. It's impossible to get a good screenshot of the original Mario Brothers on NES because there is no frame in which all enemies are completely showing, even if they're not all on the same line. Like, they just flicker. It's crazy. Anyway, so, yeah. I would have to look into those. That's very interesting. So how did the... You said that they sold out their initial stock, but how did the 7800 fare total? Like, overall, how many units were sold? How well did the games do? Because, like I said, I rarely saw the system at retail, and it just seemed like some relic from a bygone day. So I was over there, you know, buying Double Dragon or Fazanadu or something, and then, like, oh, what's this Atari? They're still around? Aren't they dead yet?
So Atari's internal numbers... for the sales, they did actually get salvaged out of a hard drive, apparently, and you can find them online. So the 7800 through 1990 sold 1.2 million units in the U.S. and Canada.
That's not very many.
That's not many at all. I know they released a press release in 1988 that they had just gotten over the 1 million mark, and that's, you know, when Nintendo had already sold, what, a couple million units in the U.S. Yeah. alone.
Yeah, didn't the NES end up selling like 50 million worldwide?
Something absurd like that.
So, yeah. And even Sega with the Master System sold a few million units.
Yeah, it sort of floundered for a while. And I mean, they sold games. From what I was reading through the sales numbers, 87 and 88 were their best years. And then in 89, it just cratered. Probably because then you had the TurboGrafx and the Genesis on the market, and
yeah.
No one really cared about the 7800 at that point.
Did the 7800 launch with the light gun? I know that they released a light gun peripheral for it. Was that something that came later?
No, it did not. The light gun, I think, came along with the Atari XE game system. I don't know why Atari decided to put out a third console. It was just...
Why the hell not?
It was just their Atari 800 XL computer, but mashed into a console.
So it was like the next wave of the 5200.
Yes, but unfortunately it wasn't backwards compatible with the 5200.
Oh my god.
But it is compatible with the 8-bit computer line, so, you know, if you have your old cartridges from 1982, you can still plop them into your XE and run those. And you could get, like, the keyboard
compelling
attachment. And, yeah, that did not do well, as far as I can tell.
Okay, because I have seen on YouTube, commercials for the 7800, or, like, a promo video or something that had light guns.
Yeah.
So it was basically, like... The XE light gun was also compatible with the 7800, but not really released as a peripheral for the 7800.
Right. It was 7800 adjacent. It's actually also compatible with the one light gun game for the 2600.
Which one is that?
Sentinel. It came out in 1991.
Ah, yes. Wow, that is a deep cut in history right there.
Yeah, the last couple 2600 games are really... interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it's not so much that, oh, a 7800 or 2600 game in 1991 as it is like a 2600 game in 1991. And by the way, it makes use of a technology that no other 2600 game has incorporated. That's wild.
Yeah, I'm not sure who at their target market there was. Like, were they going after people who had an XE and were just really gung-ho about it? Or what was happening there? I have no idea.
I guess they figured Atari fans were in for a penny and for a pound. They were just going to buy one of everything. So you have an XE, and you have a 2600, and you have a 7800, and you have a Lynx, and you're going to buy a Jaguar.
So please
just play everything all together on the same system.
And it's really funny that Atari kept publishing 2600 games just through the whole life of the 7800. And I can understand it because it's backwards compatible. The 2600s was repositioned as sort of their low cost. Here's like a $50 game system. Here's some games that are super cheap. Go nuts. And oh, by the way, if you get the 7800, you can also play these on that. It just seems odd to me because if you have such limited funds, first off, why would you put out the XE? And secondly, why would you keep devoting so much time and effort into the 2600? Like, the 2600 has a Zelda-style game that came out in 89. Why wouldn't you put that on the 7800?
Do you think that there was some sort of a significant difference in development cost that would have warranted that? I mean, it sounds ridiculous to say, but...
I mean, maybe.
It's the only thing that comes to mind.
Also, the 2600 did have a much bigger user base. I don't know how many people were buying a Zelda clone by that point for it, but that happened.
Man, it's a rough life. Okay, so we've pretty much gone through, I think, the life of the 7800. You mentioned that Atari, here in the notes, formally halted game development in May 93, and the games canceled included Pit Fighter, Toki Rampart Steel Talons, and Road Riot 4-Wheel Drive. The good news about Toki is that someone's, swear to God, is going to put it on Switch. That remake that was supposed to come 10 years ago for Xbox Live Arcade, it's coming to Switch. So that game you can finally play again. But Pit Fighter, like, it's crazy that 7800 was alive long enough for Pit Fighter to be relevant. Like I guess that game was, what, 1990? So,
that sounds right.
Yeah, so maybe it's not that wild, but it's just hard to imagine Pit Fighter being a satisfactory experience on any 8-bit system. Well, really on any system, but on an 8-bit system especially. Like, the whole appeal of that game, such as it existed, was the digitization of the graphics, and you can't do that on a 7800.
No, not in the slightest. There is a Pit Fighter prototype that's made its way out. It's really early in development, but...
unrecognizable.
Yeah, you can't tell it's Pit Fighter. It's just there. Looks like you're gonna brawl somebody.
Yeah.
It looks like a better Double Dragon than Double Dragon.
Yes.
Toki looks pretty good. I know a prototype of that surfaced a couple years ago, which was sort of around the time people realized, wait, why were they still making 7800 games when Atari canceled the system in late 91, like after Christmas? I don't know. I guess someone didn't get the memo and they just kept working on these things because they were gonna get paid. But
that's always a good reason.
Yeah.
All right. So let's talk about the software library. Now that you have all the games and I'm sure you've played them all extensively, shrug. Okay. So I asked you for a list of the worst games and you put just basically three. So Karateka, why is Karateka so bad on 7800? Because I've played the Game Boy version and it's okay. Like it functions. It's very fluidly animated and that's kind of what you want from Karateka.
So, Karateka, you know, it's an Apple II game. That's a two-button control system. And Karateka had these controls that are all set up for two buttons. You know, this one lets you do punches. This one kicks. You push this way, you'll, like, break your stance and be able to run. They did not do that on the 7800. I actually brought the manual to it,
okay,
which has...
The controls?
It has the controls in a whole, like, chart.
Wow, that's...
So you have, instead of using both buttons, as you would think, the right button on the controller just changes your stance. All the attacks are done by holding different directions on the stick and pushing the left button.
That kind of reminds me of Karate Champ on NES, where, you know, you had, like, a twin stick setup on the arcades. So on NES, it's kind of like... Well, you've got two buttons and a D-pad, so go for it, kids.
And you'd think, okay, well, I can just learn these new controls. It'll be fine, right? Well, also, there's, for whatever reason, just this massive delay between hitting the button and you actually doing something. And the hit detection is just really bad. Once that bird shows up, you're screwed. Because good luck hitting that bird. He'll hit you just fine, but... It's pretty rough.
And all right, that I'm sold. It sounds unplayable.
that's kind of the issue with a lot of like the crummier 7800 games. Like, they don't look bad if you're just looking at them in screenshots, but when you actually try to play them, they're way miserable. Off the rails. Yeah.
All right, so tell me about Impossible Mission. Why is that so bad?
So it's literally impossible is why it's bad.
Isn't that a problem with all versions of that game?
I think the PC ones are fine, but the US version of Impossible Mission has a glitch in it that one of the like clues you have to find behind like couches and chairs and beds and whatnot, it's behind a computer terminal that you can't search. You can only access the computer terminal. So you can't actually.
I thought that was the 70 or the 2600 version that had that problem. It was 78.
There's no 2600 version of Impossible Mission.
I didn't realize that famous piece of video game lore was about the 7800.
Yeah,
I feel a little smarter now.
They fixed it for the European release, but I don't think people were able to track down the glitch and fix it for like the U.S. file until recently.
Huh. All right, and so pretty much all the flight simulators, F-18, Tomcat, Super Huey. That one I think is self-explanatory. If you've ever played a flight simulator on an 8-bit console, no. Just D-pad, buttons, even the stick that the 7800 has, just no. No, it's not good. No, there's not enough going on with the hardware and the interface. They're all unpleasant.
Super Huey's the best of the bunch just because it has an arcade mode that just puts you in the air and lets you start shooting down enemy helicopters. But I remember as a kid, I pored over that manual trying to do step by step to launch the thing in the simulator mode, and it completely failing every time. Hmm. Just couldn't even get those rotors to spin.
Damn. So that's the bad stuff. But otherwise, let's talk about the good stuff. So I want to talk about the best arcade ports first, because the 7800 was an arcade, like a golden age arcade machine. You have a list of 7 games here that you pointed out as notable. So let's start with we talked about Zevius and Galaga. So that's 2 off the list. Let's talk about Joust.
Joust is actually pretty close to the arcade. I don't know how many people have played the NES Joust, in this particular audience.
Probably a fair few. It was developed for NES by HAL, so we've mentioned it a few times on the show because it was one of those proof of concepts that Nintendo and HAL put together.
Yeah, but if you'll notice on the NES one, like every time you flap, you don't really get a whole lot of height. You just sort of struggle to stay off the ground mashing the button. That doesn't really happen.
Which is weird because they did Balloon Fight right. HAL came in and saved Balloon Fight.
Yeah, I'm not sure what happened there. I don't know if Iwata did Joust first or if he just purposely made it kind of crummy.
Saving it for Balloon Fight.
But Joust on the 7800, they have much looser physics. Like, it feels more like Balloon Fight to actually play it. You move a lot more gracefully, I guess. You don't wear your thumb out as badly, which is good because the 7800 controller is incredibly painful to hold for long periods of time. Mm-hmm. And the sound chip doesn't really work against it. Like, they do pretty well with it.
So on Commando, I recently, like last year, did an NES NES Works episode on the NES conversion of Commando and had good things to say about it. I feel like it's, that was the first really ambitious arcade to NES port that Capcom put together. And people came in and said, okay, that's good, but the 7800 version is actually better. And supposedly the 7800 version is based on the Capcom NES conversion to some degree. What can you tell me about that? Like, what makes this version better than the NES version?
Well, first off, it doesn't have the flicker problem that you have on the NES one. It still has the hidden caves and such mm-hmm. that you can bomb open and then go in and rescue some prisoners, get some bonus points. They added power-ups. So, like, when you start the game, you just have, a pistol. You shoot one bullet per button press, and you can find a machine gun, and you can find a knife that lets you just touch enemies.
Oh, you can find that stuff in the NES game.
Oh, can you?
Yeah, when you go into the caves and rescue people, sometimes there's machine guns and stuff.
Oh, well,
it's very easy to lose them, though. They're hard to come by, but they are there.
This one, it's a lot easier to come by, though. Okay. They're just hanging out.
Oh, okay, yeah, you have to go into the caves and the underground passages in the NES version. Interesting. Okay.
And it uses the expanded sound chip, the Pokey, so it has really nice music, and then it uses the TIA for the sound effects, which is sort of an ideal way to handle that.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually really good. And, you know, they have like the interstitial cutscenes, including the one with him smoking that I'm pretty sure they cut from the NES
one. I think that's in the NES one.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, I think so.
It's been a while since I played the NES
one. Maybe I'm hallucinating, but there's definitely the interstitials in there.
I remember the first time I played that game, I picked up a copy in high school and my brother came in and was watching me and he remarks, "Wow, I didn't realize this was an Atari game."
Graphically, I feel like it's pretty comparable to the Zevius comparison we made earlier, where it's not leaps and bounds ahead of the NES version, but it's just enough to where your average person would probably look at it and say, yeah, this probably looks a little bit closer to the arcade version.
Yeah, I could see that.
All right, so Asteroids. That's always a tough one to do on consoles. Why does it, would you say this is the best home conversion of Asteroids?
I would.
Outside the Vectrex, maybe?
Yeah, I'm surprised it never showed up on Vectrex, even as like an aftermarket thing.
Yeah, you'd think.
But, yeah, it's interesting because they don't use the vector graphics at all. They recognize that that's just not going to work. They don't have the resolution.
Right.
So they just focused on making really pretty raster effects. So the asteroids are spheres and they're spinning and it's a really beautiful animation. And the sound effects are really nice. Like they include like little space noises and little SOS signals going off. The UFOs have this sort of metallic sound when they come flying out and start shooting at you. There's a really neat warp sound effect that I really love when you go to hyperspace and then promptly explode because you should never do that. And actually, if you can track down one of the aftermarket 2600 Asteroids controllers that I think Starplex released, it plays just like the arcade one.
So it's like buttons?
Yeah, it's all buttons. Huh.
So now tell me about Ms. Pac-Man, because Pac-Man and Atari systems have a tough existence, a tough relationship.
That's an understatement. GCC did Ms. Pac-Man for the 7800.
Okay, well, hell, geez. All right, so the original creators making the conversion.
Yeah, and it has the same sort of speed as the arcade version. I think they give you a couple more lives just because they're more generous, but it's got the speed. It looks pretty nice. It's got the cutscenes in there with music and everything.
So how's the music handled?
Not too bad. Like you heard it some.
No, it was very good. It definitely is not. I mean, Ms. Pac-Man is not, you know, full of music, even to the extent that something like Double Dragon is.
No, but it has a soundscape to it.
It does.
It has very distinctive music with a very specific sound. And then whenever you're playing, there's always a broom, 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 broom.
It does still have that going.
Okay.
I noticed all of that there.
The little waka noises, and when the fruits come in, they have the meaty bump to them, which is funny because they're fruit.
Fair enough. Okay, and then finally, Robotron 2084. That's always a tough one to pull off on consoles because it's a twin-stick shooter in arcades. And the 7800 controller, not twin-stick.
It is not, but you can use two of them to get a twin-stick thing going. They never released like an official holder for the two, but
that's a shame.
You can sort of mangle one together with some duct tape, I guess, and play it that way.
There's your next fan gamer project, Jeremy, after the Switch stand is done.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Never mind.
Yes. Okay, we'll see about a 7800 aftermarket conversion for Robotech. That's really going niche.
And, you know, you can use the buttons, but, I mean, why wouldn't you just use the twin sticks? And it's got the speed going of the arcade version, and it moves all the sprites around pretty smoothly. There's not really any slowdown or flicker. It's a really good port, really.
Okay. I might have to check that out someday. All right, so let's wrap this up by talking about the original games, the best original games that people need to hunt down and play. So you gave me, what is this, 8 games? Which is, you know, not the world's biggest library, but it's a good start. I've never played any of these, actually, so this would be entirely fresh for me. Food Fight, which technically is an arcade port, but as you note here, it's the only time that game ever had a console release.
Yeah, and it's a really cool little game. The arcade version has this 32-way joystick. And basically the premise of the game is you're this kid and you're trying to run across the screen to eat an ice cream cone before it melts. And these chefs are trying to stop you for some reason. So you have to throw food at them.
Those monsters.
Those monsters. They're coming out of manholes. They're getting pies thrown at them. So, you know, on the arcade one, you have more directions you can move. But at the same time, it's a lot easier to whiff when you're throwing stuff at the chefs. Whereas the 7800 conversion, it's an 8-way joystick, so you can only aim in 8 directions, which makes it a lot easier to hit things. And it ramps up like just so smoothly on how fast it gets each round. There's even little instant replays that pop up if you have a particularly cool round. I'm not really sure what the criteria is, but there's this fun little ditty that plays. I would say that if you are going to play anything on the system, that's one to give a shot.
All right, Ball Blazer. I'm actually familiar with this one by LucasArts, or Lucasfilm Games, I guess, at the time. So it's kind of like it's a 3D-ish game. It's hard to describe. Tell us about, like, why is this a good version of it?
Well, it's like future soccer, right? Like one-on-one. You're trying to shoot a ball into the goal on the other side, and the other person's trying to do the same. And the 7800 version just has this very smooth frame rate. It's a first-person game, so that's pretty impressive for 1984 technology. And it uses the Pokey sound chip, so you have this nice, like, techno-electronica soundtrack that goes through all these different permutations the longer you leave it running. And it has this art style that's very, like, sort of flat-shaded.
Yeah.
And it looks really cool.
Okay, that's good enough for me. But I'm curious about Desert Falcon, because that sounds like the name of a flight sim. And yet you've said flight sims are no good on 7800, so what gives?
Well, in this one, your flight sim is an isometric shooter where you're an actual falcon.
Oh, okay. So this is more like... Is this the game that's kind of like Zevius, but...
You mean Zaxxon?
Oh, Zaxxon, yeah. So it's not so much like a Jungle Strike, Desert Strike kind of game. It's more like a traditional shooter.
Yeah, and you know, the idea is that you're this falcon, and for some reason you want treasure. So you're raiding the desert and fighting sphinxes. And what makes this interesting and also kind of infuriating is the power-up system. So the way that works is you collect 3 hieroglyphs on the ground, and whatever combination of those are and what order you pick them up in will depend on what you get. So you could pick up just points. You could pick up something like invincibility or warp to the boss or fast bullets, or you can get a power down like, oh, now you can't fly or now you can't walk. And just keeping track of all of those is kind of frustrating, but the game is pretty fun.
So tell me about Alien Brigade. What's that?
You likened it to Operation Wolf last night.
It was very Operation Wolf-like.
It's a light gun game?
Yeah.
Okay.
But given the weird availability of the light gun, I wonder how many people didn't actually play it. Like, I heard a lot of people of stories, or people telling stories of playing Operation Wolf here, which is what they just used the controller. The D-pad.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's an Operation Wolf-style game. You start off thinking you're fighting people, and there's an actual narrative that runs through between each stage, and suddenly you're fighting aliens, and you have to go to the alien mother base and
I don't think that
shoot
happened
them up.
In Operation Wolf, to be fair. But
I mean, I never made it that far in Operation Wolf.
Okay, so basically a standard arcade shooter of the era, which again, on 84 hardware is pretty impressive.
Yeah, and it looks really good for what it is.
So what is Dark Chambers? I've never heard of that game at all.
It's basically what they based Gauntlet off of. It's a dungeon crawler.
Wait, like, so it predates Gauntlet?
When did Gauntlet come out exactly?
86.
I think I think it was in development before Gauntlet. I don't know that it came out before Gauntlet, but it's a you're going through caverns looking for keys to go on. It's a two-player game. It's just there's no time limit. You're not going to starve to death because they're not trying to steal your quarters.
Right. So Gauntlet, but better in a way.
Yeah, and it has
except only two players.
Yeah, and it has a really cool title screen. Like, if nothing else, you can take a look at that.
So did Gauntlet, though.
That's true.
Yeah.
I guess if nothing else, these games are good for title screens. okay, so we're kind of winding down. Ninja Golf, you said people have been talking about a lot here at Midwest Gaming Classic and just other places in general. Why is that? Is this like, is it suddenly time for Ninja Golf to be recognized 30 years later? Is this its chance to shine?
I think it's probably the most unique game on the 7800.
Easily.
And, you know, when you get to Atari's like original games, they're getting really weird. And that's the case here. So the idea behind Ninja Golf is that you're a golfer who's also a ninja. So you
with you so far.
Yep. So you hit the ball.
Golf is very popular in Japan.
That is true. So you hit the ball and then you have to fight your way to the ball. So it becomes a brawler, basically.
Okay. That sounds like a pretty unusual interpretation of golf.
Right.
So what's the balance of like sports game to brawler gameplay?
Oh, there's barely any sports game. You
yeah.
basically target where the ball is and then you time it right so it flies as far as you can. And once you get to the green, you fight a dragon. And sort of like the and it's sort of like the Shinobi bonus stage where
the
you're like
oh yeah, you're like sequences.
Yeah.
Okay, so it kind of sounds like this game was totally ripped off by Battle Golfer Yui for Sega Mega Drive.
But Battle Golfer Yui was just like an
yeah, there's
anime
no actual
story.
Fight. Yeah,
like it didn't have anything that made it actually.
Yeah, like they heard about Ninja Golf and were like, "Oh, we could do that."
Yeah.
Without actually knowing how it played.
Exactly.
They blew it. They blew it.
They did.
Yeah, it's too bad Ninja Golf didn't have an ending where you accidentally blow up the city.
Have you gotten to the end of it?
No,
so
but...
how do you not know? It
that is
that
true.
End.
Atari could have thrown me for a loop here.
Is it just 18 holes?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. So there should be an end.
Yeah. Just have to get there. Have to fight enough dragons.
Like, I feel like that is a game that is due for... like at least a concept that's due to be revisited.
I know there's a Flash remake of it, which is probably why everyone's heard of it compared to basically anything else on the system.
And at least for me, if you had to pick like one gem from that library, I really think this is it.
And then there's Midnight Mutants, another game that I don't know that maybe I have heard of it, but it's got Grandpa Munster on it.
Yes, it does.
Yes, the title.
Is it actually a Munsters game?
No,
or
it is not. They did not have the...
They just said, forget likeness rights, screw it.
They had the rights to Al Lewis's face, but they did not have the rights to Munsters, so they just call him Grandpa, and he's supposed to be your grandfather in an Al Lewis Munsters costume for Halloween.
But he does continue to make very Grandpa Munster-style jokes throughout the entire game.
Yeah, and it's sort of this Zelda-style game where you're wandering through this town, you have to rescue him and stop the resurrection of Dr.
Evil. This is the 7800's equivalent of Fester's Quest, isn't it?
But much better.
Oh, okay.
Because when you die, you don't... Well, I guess you technically do start back over, but it's...
Does it feel as punitive?
No, it's not as punitive. You don't have as long a road to reclimb.
Huh. You've got me intrigued. I might have to check this game out.
And, you know, there's items in there that you pick up. Like, you can find a knife, and that's your first weapon. You can find a cross that will make bats, like, leave you alone. And
okay.
It's a weird little game. I think it was the last one to come out in the U.S. in 1991. So it's kind of hard to find. It didn't really sell
really
very
timely
well.
Timely opportunity to bring out a Munsters game, right, as the Addams Family is relaunched.
Yeah. Well,
that's really weird.
Well, you know, NES had the Addams Family locked down with Fester, so they had to go with the knockoff.
I guess so. That doesn't speak well of the 7800, though. It makes me feel kind of bad for it.
It's a little...
All right, and we'll wrap this up by talking about the last game on your best of list, Scrapyard Dog. What is that?
So it's a Mario-style platformer on a system that didn't have any other Mario-style platformers.
Well, no wonder it only sold 1.2 million units. If it didn't have Mario-style platformers in the Age of Mario, like, they were just asking for it.
And I think it's worth noting that, like, Midnight Mutants and Ninja Golf and Scrapyard Dog, these all came out sort of around 1990, 91, so that they did eventually sort of pivot to NES-style experiences when people cared about at that point in time. They just did it after the Genesis had already launched.
Right. These games, how common are they in the market? I feel like they must have sold, you know, tens of thousands of units, not hundreds of thousands.
The last, like, allotment of games, they're not really easy to come by. Some of the third-party games are harder to find, and they didn't come out as late that I'm aware of. Like, Tank Command is this weird little tank-driving shooter, and it's really hard to come by. Hmm. Even these last few are pretty... they're pretty tricky to find. I remember, so after Atari dropped the 7800, they just liquidated everything to Big Lots and other, you know, clearance stores, which is where I ended up buying most of my games for it. And I never saw any of these.
Okay.
So I don't know how many copies they had, but they certainly weren't there.
So they're not that common. Are they expensive or are they pretty reasonably priced still?
I mean, you can get them probably around 40, 50 bucks if you're patient.
Okay. Yeah, I'm compared to collecting for Game Boy and NES and Super NES. So that's very reasonable. Wow, what a bargain.
Yeah, you can get through most of this library for under 100 bucks.
All right. And that is the main determinant on anyone's desire to play. How many 7800 games were there total?
I want to say 59, thereabouts.
Okay, so not even many. As many as for Lynx.
No, there's not even as many for the Master System.
Oh. Well, Master System had quite a life, actually.
It did.
Lynx, though, like, I feel like that was always an also-ran, but it had, I think, 70 games. So, kind of rough for the 7800. But I suppose if you are looking to build a complete collection, if you're one of those people who's like, I need to own everything for a system, that might be a good place to start. What's the most expensive game on the system? Like, how much does it cost?
It'd probably be Tank Command. I think I picked that one up last year for $120, which, you know, compared to, again, NES and Game Boy is peanuts, right? But, I mean, it's expensive for this system anyway. Mm-hmm. And after that, I'd say the most expensive, like, first-party game is Mean 18 Golf, which is, I mean, it's an NES-style golf game. I think it's based off of a computer game by Accolade.
Okay. They always did good stuff.
And that one was like 60 or 70 bucks.
Hmm. All right.
Not terrible.
Okay, so any final thoughts on the 7800? Like I said, I haven't had much experience with it, but honestly, like, talking about it and just kind of looking at the library, especially the arcade ports, makes me really want to go back and investigate it. And I suppose I don't have any excuse not to, since the Analog NT does have a jailbroken core for the 7800. So those games are all right there beckoning me. I have no excuses.
Yeah, it's just this weird little corner of that 8-bit market where you weren't getting the Japanese, all the refined Japanese releases from the Famicom or the Mark III. And there's a lot more, I guess you could say, experimental games on there. Like, I don't know who would be putting out something like Ninja Golf necessarily on the NES.
I don't know. You had the weird stuff from companies like Meldak, like Zombie Nation.
Okay, granted.
Yeah, like Mindell Palace and stuff. Like, there were certainly some weirdo games on NES, but it's good that there was another system out there that had, like, these super bizarre, like, where did this come from kind of things.
Yeah, I'm not sure what they were thinking for some of these games. Like, there's a basketball game that's basically arch rivals, but
Is it Basket Brawl?
Yes.
Okay.
I think that's on Lynx, too.
I think so, yeah. Too bad there wasn't, like, a connection between Lynx and 7800, like with Dreamcast and Neo Geo Pocket.
Yeah, that would have been kind of cool. It's kind of funny, because some of these late 7800 games also came out on the Lynx, but they were really different. Like, Scrapyard Dog got a Lynx version that I've heard is not as good as the 7800 one. I've never actually tried it. And Basket Brawl, it's sort of the other way around. Apparently the Lynx one's much better.
Huh. Interesting.
But it's an interesting little console. I mean, if you have an afternoon and want to just check out some of the weird stuff that was coming out of the US in the late 80s, it's it's a worthwhile little journey.
All right. Well, thank you for sharing your expertise on a system that I couldn't have done an episode on by myself, for sure.
Yeah, well, glad to be here.
So we'll wrap this Retronauts here, and I will go through the usual banter. I'm Jeremy Parrish. You can find me on Twitter as GameSpite and at Retronauts.com, et cetera, on YouTube. You can find Retronauts at Retronauts.com, on iTunes, et cetera, and Podcast One. And, of course, we are supported through Patreon, patreon.com/Retronauts, which is how we feed our babies. So please support us for $3 a month or more. If you want to do more, that's cool. But $3 a month gets you one week access to our episodes 1 week ahead of time, all episodes. And they're in higher bit quality, audio quality. Like, you know, using the onboard cartridge chips as opposed to the TIA. That's the difference right there. And there's no ads. So it's a pretty cool deal, and it keeps us from starving. And that's always awesome. You guys go ahead and give your spiels, too.
Okay. I'm on Twitter at Ubersaurus. I also have a YouTube channel, Atari Archive, which is a chronological slog through the Atari VCS library. It's more fun than that, but you know, the first couple of years are kind of rough. And I have a Patreon for that, patreon.com/AtariArchive. And since we're in, you know, beautiful Milwaukee, where it's raining and gray, and you have Lake Michigan right there, if you care about the Great Lakes, you can check out some of my science writing at ijc.org.
All right. And Brian?
You can find me on Twitter at bclarkomp, and also please check out 1millionpower.com, which is just my own site that I like to write for, from anything to weird old Japanese games to Japanese music to translating Famitsu features about game creators' cats.
I didn't realize 1 Million Power was you.
It is.
Okay, that's awesome. Wow, I didn't realize we had a celebrity in our midst.
Oh,
damn.
Come on.
No, but yeah, there's some great stuff on that site. It's a great site.
Oh, thank you.
So yeah, thank you also for coming on to the show. Although, as you said at the beginning, you're not as versed in the 7800 as Kevin, but...
I just came to complain about Double Dragon.
Yeah, no, that's great. I always appreciate people complaining about bad games.
Someone had trouble.
But yeah, that wraps it up for this episode of Retronauts, and I'm sure we'll do some more stuff at next year's Midwest Gaming Classic, so look forward to it. This week in Retronauts, Atari got a raw deal. Hi, everyone, and welcome to, what is this, the third time Retronauts has been live at Midwest Gaming Classic?
It is number three.
It is the year 2018, and we're on our third go. And it's a much bigger crowd than usual, and even with the door open at the back, it's much quieter and saner in here than it's been in the past. So I have a good feeling about this presentation.
Presumably, I won't be harassed by drunks after this panel.
Actually,
prove me
Bob,
wrong, audience.
I have plans tonight.
Oh, God.
So, yes, hello. If you are not familiar with the Retronauts podcast, my name is Jeremy Parrish, and that's my co-host down there.
Hey, it's Bob Mackey. Hello.
And
wow.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we are talking about Atari this week, so we have a few experts with us. To my left, why don't you introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Marty Goldberg. I'm a partner in the Atari Museum and a co-author of Atari Inc. Business is Fun and two other forthcoming books on the same subject, the two companies that came after that, Atari Corp. and Atari Games.
So we brought in the heavy hitters this time, which wasn't hard since he's always here at the show. And also to my right is... Oh, you don't have a mic?
No, I get to steal a mic.
I'm Kevin Bunch. I do the Atari Archives videos on YouTube. I enjoy Atari history, so I'm something of an amateur historian.
Well, actually, this panel is kind of your fault, Kevin. I bumped into you last year on the vendor floor, and you were trying to complete your Atari 7800 collection. Are you done with that now?
Yep.
All right. So this is a man who owns all the 7800 games. And so I was originally thinking it would be cool to have a panel on the Atari 7800, but then I thought that might be kind of dry. Why don't we find something with a little more drama to it? And so that's what this panel is about. It's about looking back at the history of Atari and saying, you know, the Atari crash, the video games crash in 1982-83, did a number on Atari, but was that entirely their fault? And did they really deserve the sort of fallout that happened to them? And personally, I say no. I think it's kind of in vogue to say, well, if they hadn't published E.T. and Pac-Man, you know, done such bad jobs with those Atari 2600 games, nothing bad would have happened to the games industry. But I don't think that's true. And I think everyone else here on the panel with me kind of agrees with that point of view. So we are going to look back and reconsider Atari and maybe try to rewrite history a little bit and give them a fair shake. So without further ado, why don't we roll into this conversation? The Atari crash is, I guess, a good place to kind of start, the video games crash, or I think in Japan it's called the Atari shock. Basically, it has to do with Atari, and it has to do with a lot of people losing money hand over fist. And I think we're all familiar with the idea behind that, but I don't know if someone else wants to jump in and kind of give a top-down view of what that was all about.
So what specifically do you want me to start out with it?
Let's just talk about what the Atari crash was.
Okay.
And kind of what happened after it.
Very loosely to cover, because we're going to go over details after this. Basically, what you had was an environment of an explosion of demand in the early 80s in video games and the consumer industry. Now, it's a very important point to make. At that point in time, there was not what you would call now a video game industry. You had various industries with video games in them. You had very few companies. Atari was one of them that actually straddled multiple industries and could be considered what you would consider now a video game company in those respects. They were in other things. No, they were the Apple of the day, of that day. I mean, how you think of Apple today? They were involved not just in entertainment. They were also involved in medical equipment research, telephones, modern telephones. A lot of the features that you have in your phones today were actually pioneered back then. They were going in holography. They were going in all sorts of different consumer and advanced areas. They even had Alan Kay, who is legendary from Xerox PARC, who created partially responsible for the team that created the modern Windows mouse and everything else environment. They had him there researching the office of the future for 10 years like he had been doing at Xerox. So they were far ahead of things in that. So, you know, Atari was one of the few companies that straddled that. But at that point in time, you did not have an industry like you had now. You had other industries that happened to have video games in them. So it was pretty much the Wild West. And that demand just spiked across 81 through 82. And then you had basically a perfect storm going on into 82 and 83, where you had all these third-party companies come in too, and you had the issues with the already established companies that we're going to discuss in a bit. And they came together to basically not just flood the industry, but create this perfect storm of loss of demand is what it is. Because they, you know, again, it was a new environment for a lot of these companies to operate in. And within another year, a lot of them were already exiting doing any sort of video games. So that what you had was you had an industry going away. You still had a demand and a market, but that was rapidly shrinking too over 83 and 84 then. So that by the time, you know, there was still plenty of product, but the companies that were behind it weren't necessarily there anymore. And, you know, because that's another thing too. There's this thing that there's this idea that before Nintendo came in, there was nothing there. There was like a gap. There was still a market. It was a lot smaller, but there were still video games being sold, consumer video games. And that's an important point too. This was a consumer crash,
right?
Not coin. The coin industry, you know, we've got a ton of the old arcade games here, as I'm sure a lot of you have seen. That's a completely different industry. They run on their own market. They run on their own resources, separate from what the consumer was. And even then, it was a North American crash because it didn't necessarily have to affect worldwide. Europe was video game market was mainly on computers during that time. So they weren't as affected. Same for Asia and around there too. They had a different market as well. It was mainly the North American consumer market, consumer video games that crashed.
Yeah, while the American market was crashing in 1983, Japan was just getting its first homegrown consoles. You know, the Famicom, Nintendo's made its entry. The Sega SG-1000, the MSX standard, like all of these things were starting over there and beginning to take off right as America's market was cratering. So it was really the American console market. So when people talk about the video games crash and tend to think of it, you know, like, oh, video games went away everywhere for a few years. That's absolutely not true. But, you know, it was definitely the American console industry, and it affected more than just Atari. When the big crash happened, in addition to taking Atari with it, it also affected Mattel, who had the Intellivision. It affected Coleco, who had the ColecoVision. It, you know, there were lots of other companies. Whoever made the Vectrex, what was the company there?
GCE,
okay. So like all of them were affected. And of course, Atari had been acquired by Warner Communications in 1976. And it was, I think at that point, the largest corporate merger that had ever happened in the world. So they were a huge company. And, you know, the biggest symbol of the crash that happened in 83 was that Warner lost, I think, 60 or 65% of its stock value. So Atari managed to take down with this, you know, the collapse of the 2600 market, one of the biggest media conglomerates in the world. So it was a, you know, it was very localized and specific, but it there were a lot of side effects and a lot of detrimental effects. And you know, the name Atari has been sort of attached to this, like it is the Atari crash, the Atari shock. And so they tend to get the blame for it. But again, I don't think that's all entirely fair. Like some, they made some poor choices, but there were lots of other people out there making equally bad decisions, if not worse. And so it was a whole lot of, I don't know, I would say it was people kind of finding this new form of entertainment, this new space in the market, this new industry, and not really having a sense of what was sustainable while they were, you know, sort of freewheeling and spitballing and trying to figure out like what works in video games. They were also discovering the hard way, what does not work in video games.
I'd like to posit one thing. I think the crash had a positive effect actually in some ways, not for the companies who made the games obviously, but I think the crash actually opened up a whole new demographic to console gaming, people that couldn't previously afford the systems. Growing up in a poor family, it was like, yes, an Atari is $50. All of the cartridges are like $1 everywhere, so you could easily stock up on every game you wanted if you had a small budget.
Yeah, I mean, that's like from the consumer side, that seems good, but that's definitely not, you know, sustainable as a business.
I'm pro-consumer, Jeremy.
It's, I am too, but there is, you know, kind of the reality that if no one's making money, then no one's going to be making more of these things that we love. So there is the kind of push and pull of capitalism. Like there's got to be some upside for people so that they can devote their lives to making video games to entertain the rest of us. And, you know, this is cyclical. Like we see this all the time. We see it on Steam. We see it. It's probably going to happen with, you know, Nintendo Switch as it's gone from being like this very profitable place to suddenly, you know, just the past few months flooded with all kinds of software. And it's getting hard to say like, I want a Switch game, but which Switch game do I want? There's, you know, 30 coming out this week. Which of the 30 do I want? I think, you know, that's just the gold rush effect. Anytime there's money to be made, there's profit to be made, people jump in and things get crowded. And that definitely is what happened with the Atari 2600, for sure. Do we want to talk about some of the causes of the crash beyond, you know, E.T. and Pac-Man?
Sure. I think Kevin was...
Yeah, there's a lot of things that were going on at the time. So, you know, everyone looks at Atari and they blame Atari's quality control at the time. But the fact of the matter is they were putting out a lot of pretty good games in 82 and 83. Like, 82, you had Berserk, you had Yar's Revenge, you had Defender. 83, you had games like Ms. Pac-Man and Gravatar that people consider to be pretty darn good games. But everyone just looks at Pac-Man and they look at E.T. and they're like, oh, these must be the problem. But the problem really goes beyond Atari, because you also had this massive glut of third parties that hit the market in late 82 and into 83 that was just releasing wave after wave of games that, you know, some of them were good, some of them were mediocre, but there was just so many you wouldn't really be able to tell which is which. They're all full price. The magazines couldn't really keep up with it. Like they might get around to reviewing a game months after it came out and might have been discounted by that point.
Yeah, you couldn't jump on Twitter in 1982 and say, hey friends, which game should I buy for Atari? Like that form of, you know, feedback and critical analysis just wasn't there. I think there was one video game magazine running at the time.
No, there were, I'd say 82 is when you had more of the explosion of video game magazines. There were a bunch of them. But yeah,
they were mostly focused on computers, though, weren't they?
Arcade.
Okay.
Arcade was where it was at in that time period, because that's where most of the original games were being generated, and then people wanted to be able to play those at home. I'd say around 82, like when you start seeing Yars, or 81, 82, when you start seeing Yars Revenge and some of the original titles coming out, that's really when you started having the beginnings of a shift in the home industry, where people wanted new games that weren't available in their arcades, that were specific to a platform, that were something that they could go and they could just play at home. But before that, they were mainly taking their lead from COIN, because that's where all the money was, that's where all the development was being done, and that's where people were still socializing. You know, before your Xbox Live and everything else that you have now, that's what you would do. You would go to the arcade and play with your friends and hang out there for the day and play your games and visit and stuff like that too. So,
and I think you mentioned, Kevin, third parties, and I think that really does have a huge impact. I don't know if you can really point at one thing about the Atari crash and say that's it, but man, third parties were really part of the problem. And there were some third parties, which is to say, you know, companies making games for Atari that were not Atari themselves. There were some very good third parties, but if you have ever, you know, just kind of done a random trawl of the 2600 library, and once you start getting into the games that were not made by Atari or made by Activision, which was, you know, a company formed by people who left Atari, you get into some pretty dire stuff, and it stops being fun really quickly. And you can really understand why people would go to the store, pay $30, which was a lot in 1983 money, in the middle of a recession, and bring home something that was incomprehensible, unplayable, just not fun at all. They would say, well, I don't want to buy more of these games because I just got burned.
Yeah, I'm not sure when the price drop started happening, but when the VCS launched, the 2600 launched, it was the equivalent of like $800 today, or maybe $900 today. So it was pretty expensive. It was like the price of a PC gaming rig almost.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was an investment, and there were always, in my experience as a kid living back then who did not have a 2600, you know, you always kind of knew who your classmates were and who the kids in the neighborhood were who had a 2600. Because it was kind of a luxury item. And so the kids who had it, like everyone kind of somehow ended up at their house to play video games. It was a strange phenomenon.
Yeah, with regards to the third parties too, and as far as, with your point with Activision too, the co-founder of that company is going to be here tomorrow, David Crane. He will be speaking tomorrow too. But in relation to that, I mean, Activision is really what opened that up. Because, you know, people say, well, why didn't Atari lock out the 2600? Or why didn't they keep other people from manufacturing for it? Well, because before Activision came around and those employees left and started that company, that wasn't a concept. Okay. There was no such thing as third party. These were all, they not necessarily proprietary platforms, but this was such a new industry that you needed so much money to get into and to develop. Or it was never thought that somebody else was going to come along and just start developing games, because they didn't even know how long video games and home games were going to last, because they were constantly being called at that time a fad. So the idea that somebody would come along and start making games for it wasn't fathomable.
There was also a lot of protectionism happening in the market. You know, Coleco came out with the expansion module for the ColecoVision that basically stuck an Atari 2600 on your ColecoVision. So you put in this adapter and all of a sudden you could play Atari 2600 games. And of course, Atari took that to court. They weren't happy about that at all.
Yeah, yeah, very much so. I mean, you had that with hardware as far as patents and even games. The games themselves, like you had Atari, once they got the license for Pac-Man, suing Magnavox for Casey Munchkin. Because again, this whole concept of protection in this field wasn't necessarily there beyond the hardware. And once the hardware done, I mean, Coleco had claimed that they had clean room reverse engineered everything. What happened is they wound up settling out of court, licensing, and then paying royalties on everything that was sold. So Atari actually made money off of that. But, you know, getting back to that with that third party thing, people that I've interviewed that were there at CES, the summer of 82, you had Atari doing the 5200 coming out with that. You had Coleco, surprisingly, because everybody thought they had exited video games, all of a sudden coming out with the ColecoVision and showing it off there. You had all sorts of things going on, but the thing that staggered most people was all of a sudden you had these third-party companies, a ton of them, show up at the Consumer Electronics Show. It was a summer one down south of here in Chicago at that time, at McCormick when they used to have it. And they were like, this isn't good, because nobody was prepared for it. And they just, the market's just, you know, it was already starting to get crowded with the companies that were there all competing with all these different consoles. And now you have all these third parties. And it's insane that in a year, 1982, a year that the actual overall earnings of video games were huge, you actually had a lot of companies starting to lose a lot of money because of that, because of fighting for all that market share and because of all their own issues too.
Yeah, the pie was getting bigger, but the number of people wanting a piece of the pie were exploding, you know, exponentially compared to the size of the pie's growth. So that just wasn't sustainable. So I think you can kind of make a case that the existence and the proliferation of third parties kind of was Atari's fault, because Activision, like the people who formed that company, left because they weren't happy at Atari. And I think that ultimately goes back to the point that in 1976, Warner Communications bought Atari, and it went from being this like kind of freewheeling hippie company out in California to a more buttoned-down corporation that had to, you know, it was a division of a larger, very established firm. And it didn't treat its talent as talent. It treated them like commodities, like you are creating these game ideas and programming games and making art and music or sound effects. But, you know, there's nothing special about you. Anyone can do that. You're just, you know, assembling products for us. And obviously, we know that's not true. Video games are not just assembly line products, or they shouldn't be. And the best games come with a lot of heart, a lot of creativity, a lot of vision. And I think, you know, the people who went off to form Activision felt that way very strongly and resented being treated like, you know, assembly line people. And so they went off and formed their own company. And that started this chain effect a chain of events that that ended up kind of destroying the market, just because once Activision was out there making games without a license from Atari, everyone said, oh, we can do that too. But again, they weren't Activision. They didn't have years of experience working with the Atari 2600 hardware. They weren't people from Atari who understood, you know, not only consumer research, like what do people want, but how do you make a good game? How do you come up with a good idea? So, that was really kind of, I guess if you wanted to point to an ultimate cause and effect here, it would be the Warner acquisition, in my opinion. I don't know. You guys may disagree.
I think you're right. I mean, it's a tale as old as time when a company is bought out by people who don't understand the product and aren't consumers of the product, and then proceed to ruin the product. So it happens all the time.
Well, I mean, technically, too, you could say Atari and the people at that time in 1976 didn't understand the product either, because they were just getting into it as far as the consumer market. That's why part of why the acquisition happened. I mean, they had been in dire financial straits a number of years before that because of some bad decisions made and some poor management brought in. So that then they were looking for investors. They got a few of those, but not enough. And then they went and basically got hooked up through a mutual investment firm with Warner. Now, Warner did, I mean, keep in mind, Atari at that time was an engineering research firm. That was really how they were run. They were not run as a gaming company in those regards. They were there purely to go after all the different ideas that Nolan would come up with that he wanted to pursue. And they were run as an engineering firm, a startup. Warner is the one that came in and brought in the big boy pants for that, and a lot of the oversight that was actually needed. Unfortunately, they were also big boys that needed to fill bigger pockets. So they also were chiefly responsible for a lot of the issues and a lot of dual management, like what you talked about with the guys, how they were treated, the ones that left for Activision and other ones too, because it was an exodus across 78 and 79. That had a lot to do with what's called Hollywood accounting, and which you hear about in movies and films. These guys were promised a lot of different profit shares and things like that. They were seeing earnings happen for the company, but yet they weren't getting what they had been promised. And what had happened was the people that Warner would bring in, or Warner themselves, would shift stuff around to show losses, you know, things like that. You know, we can't give you what you're asking for yet, type of thing. And then you had these guys leave. Ray Cassaro, who just passed away, he is chiefly responsible for the golden age of what we all think of with Atari. He's also responsible for its downfall, as is Warner and Manny Gerard and that group there. You know, they were the ones that put the pressure on to keep earnings piling up and piling up when that started happening in the early 80s. They were the ones that wanted to inflate their own earnings. They were the ones that would go in, and there were projects that were almost ready to be released, and they were like, why are we doing this? You know, we shouldn't be doing this. And nix them. You know, they were the ones chiefly responsible. They were the ones responsible for E.T. They were, because it was basically the head of Warner was at a party with Spielberg and had been trying to get him to come over to release his films through Warner, and hammered out a deal at his home in the Hamptons over the weekend to do this game. And that was already the beginning of the summer, and Spiel was like, well, it's got to be out in time for Christmas. Oh yeah, no problem. They thrust it on Atari, and then they have to go and negotiate. It takes more time, and then by that time, you know, it's going over, and you know, it's finally Howard's brought on board. He's got very little time left, because in order to make it for that time period, for the Christmas season, it's got to be into manufacturing by the beginning of September. So, you know, they were the ones that were doing a lot of this stuff. They were responsible for its golden age, and they were responsible for its downfall and a lot of that too. Some of it was a necessary evil. So,
You know, if you want to come up with some other things that maybe Atari shouldn't have done, I would say the other big one would be the 5200. Like, what even was that? Like, why did they do that? Kevin, do you know?
Well, my understanding is they really wanted to compete with Mattel's Intellivision, which came out around 79 in test markets, and then they released it nationally in 1980. And Mattel just kept running all these ads after ads, just directly comparing their games and their system to the 2600. And like, look, we have way better sports games. We have better animation. We have better visuals.
I think George Plimpton's claim was lifelike graphics.
They have lifelike
graphics.
They were
much more convincing stickmen than Atari had.
You can see He-Man sword fight Skeletor eventually. But running all these ads, they've got this controller that has like this six-way disc control pad and all these buttons and this keypad. And Atari says, well, you know what? We can one-up them. We'll just repackage this Atari 400 computer. We'll make this weird controller that has this analog stick that doesn't recenter on its own and has these buttons that'll turn to mush even if you don't use it. Which is my favorite thing about the 5200s. The controllers will just go out on you without you even touching them. And we're gonna sell all of these games that we've already been working on for our computer line.
And that's the important thing, is that it was based on the Atari computer line and therefore had no compatibility with the 2600. So they had two effectively competing consoles in the market. And it's not like, you know, when Nintendo has Switch and 3DS on the market and they're kind of in the same space, but not really. This was like two consoles that were very much, you know, just one had a huge library of games and the other had a smaller library, but looked a little nicer. So it was very confusing for consumers. And like you said, there were a lot of sort of downsides to the 5200 hardware. So it wasn't an obvious case where, oh, you know, like Nintendo to Super Nintendo or Sega Genesis to Sega Saturn, like there's going to be a huge leap. No, it was like, which would you rather invest in? So that didn't do them any favors, I would say.
Yeah, and I think it's worth noting that this was also really the first time any company had been releasing a sort of successor console. So,
there was the Odyssey 2, but that might be so far back in the primal ooze that it doesn't really count.
I mean, the Odyssey was a dedicated machine from 71. Odyssey 2 was from, 79?
78, 79.
Yeah, so that's a pretty wide gap at that point, and there was a lot of years between the two. But what this is like, okay, you've got the 2600 on the market. Here's our new system. Well, what do we do with the 2600? It's still making us money. Let's just try and support them both and see what happens. And then, you know, ColecoVision came along. Like, oh no, this is better than what we've got.
Can I add to that? Go ahead.
Sure. So a couple things in regards to that. They actually, the 5200 development, what was called System X, actually started before anybody knew about ColecoVision with that. It, like you said, started as an television thing. There was a console before that called the 3200 that was originally going to be the successor. That went out because it had a 12-bit graphics chip that was very hard to program. It was an 8-bit CPU and a 12-bit graphics chip, and didn't get far. The design carried through, though, into what became the 5200 as far as the case design. When they started the 5200, there were three projects at that time. There was, they were basically doing the cost reduced 2600 because in relation to what you were saying earlier, they understood the market as far as the need for more, having lower cost items on it so people could afford it easier. So they were actually moving towards that at that time. So 2600 is going to reposition as a lower end. Then you had what became the 5200 as a mid, and they were going to work on a higher end console as well. And then what happened is Warner basically is like, 2600 is our cash cow. You can't do anything to jeopardize that. So the plan changed, and they did the 5200, and it was positioned as a higher end, as the higher end gaming system. So it wouldn't affect the 2600 market. And it was supposed, it was designed from the beginning to have the 2600 compatible cartridge thing as well, to help so people wouldn't have to get rid of that and would continue to buy, hopefully, 2600 games as well. But that wasn't ready in time for the release. So then it got the myth that involved that, oh, 5200 was not designed to be backwards compatible. It actually was. It just wasn't ready in time. But so that was the idea. That's how the 5200 came about. It was supposed to be a three-pronged approach for that. So,
but yeah, obviously that didn't happen.
No.
And, you know, I think it's good that Kevin mentioned the computer line, because that is sort of the other big thing that was happening in video games right around this time. Like the 2600 launched the same year as the Apple II, and the Apple II was sort of the introduction of, like, hey, you know, computers for the masses. But, you know, the 2600 was a lot less expensive than the Apple II. But in 1981, Commodore brought out the Commodore 64, and suddenly there was a computer that could do a lot, had very great, you know, audio and video effects, and really didn't cost that much more than a console. So all of a sudden, you had something that was far more versatile than a video game system that also played video games. And, you know, I think it became harder for people to make a case for keeping a console in the home when instead they could invest that money into the C64 and some of the other computers that came along around the same time, like the TI-99/4A and what else, like the VIC-20 and so forth. So, yeah, all of a sudden, you know, the consoles weren't sort of existing in this space by themselves. There were other devices that suddenly could, you know, affordably play video games in the home, and they could also, you know, do your recipes or whatever they tried to pitch people on for computers back then. And I think that you know, these are just all the things that kind of came together to cause the video game crash, and that took down Atari and Intellivision and ColecoVision and so on and so forth, and made retailers specifically very, very gun shy about buying video games, you know, console video games, and trying to sell them, because they had these bins of the $1 video games that Bob mentioned. And it wasn't until Nintendo came along 3 or 4 years later and said, hey, but what if we pretended these weren't video games? It was an entertainment system with a video robot and a gun, and you buy game packs instead of cartridges. Like, that's totally different. That's not video games at all, guys. Like, retailers went for it, but consumers knew what was up. They were like, oh, yes, video games. We actually still like those. It's just, you know, no one wants to get into that business anymore. So there was that kind of, like, 3 or 4 year sort of trough, a lacuna in the U.S. console market, where a lot of it had to do with retailers just getting burned and not wanting to get back into that space again.
I do want to point out that not only were there all these computers on the market, but there was also a glut of hardware consoles on the market in 82 and 83. Like, you know, you had the ColecoVision and you had the 2600 and the 5200 and the Intellivision and the Odyssey 2 and the Vectrex and the Arcadia 2001 and the Astrocade. And there's still the Channel F was still on the market. You could still buy that.
So, like I said, Warner's stock crashed hard in 1982-83 as a result of this. And they said, we need to get rid of this dead weight around our necks. So they spun off Atari, and Atari went in basically two directions.
The head of Warner couldn't get rid of Atari. Nobody would buy it off of him. They had just come off of a hostile. I'm sure you guys are familiar with Rupert Murdoch in news recent years. He tried to take over Warner during that time period when it was very vulnerable. They fended him off, but it hurt them. And they brought in a company to basically evaluate what they could get rid of so that they weren't as exposed. One of the things, obviously, was Atari. So he tried, Steve Ross, the head of Warner, tried to get rid of it. Nobody wanted the company as a whole. So then he came up with the idea, okay, I'll just split it up. So basically what happened was he cold called Jack Tramiel, who had left Commodore earlier and had come back and started his own company, Tramiel Technology, to see if he'd be interested in buying the consumer division, the consumer assets. And they negotiated, and that actually happened. Now, to keep in mind, he did not sell Tramiel Atari. Atari Corporation, the company that came out there, was a completely separate company, completely different company. He sold Ross and Warner, sold them the assets. Assets purchases are basically their IP, buildings, things like that. They don't include the employees. And basically, you hire over employees to help maintain those assets that you are purchasing. So what he did was he put those assets into a new company he formed called Atari Corporation. Now, the other part of the rest of the company actually continued on as Atari Inc. for a day, and then was renamed Atari Games Inc. And with, what's his name still at the head at that time? Trying to remember who was brought in to try and save Atari at that time. From the tobacco industry. Anyway, so what happened was it was renamed Atari Games Inc. And they slowly pared that down until it was just the arcade part. And then that was had majority ownership sold to Namco. And Namco renamed it Atari Games Corp. And then that survived a number of years. It was actually the last vestiges of the original Atari left. I think it went out in 2003 was when it was finally
closed
down.
Something like that, but didn't it get absorbed by Midway or something?
They went back and forth. They got employee bought. There was a three. It was basically a three-way for a time. It was a third employee, a third Namco, and third Warner. Warner still kept stake in it. And then they wound up, the employees sold out to Warner, and they became Time Warner Interactive. And then that was sold to Midway, and then it got renamed to Atari Games again, and then eventually Midway Games West, and then it was gone in 2003.
Right.
So that's what happened with that.
And what a mess.
Yes.
But, you know, the Atari Games itself, the company that existed, you know, and carried forward that sort of tradition under Namco's watch, they made some amazing arcade games. They made stuff like Gauntlet and Rampart 720, Stunrunner. Yeah, like there's Paperboy. Yeah, there is some great stuff that came out from this company. So they continued on, but it still feels like they were kind of a shadow of what they had been. They had been synonymous with video games. You know, you played Atari. You didn't play video games. Even if you were playing in television, you were playing Atari, kind of like Nintendo would be in the 80s, like late 80s, it would be playing Nintendo, playing Atari. Those were like just, you know, nothing was more symbolic of the transfer of power, I think, between the two halves of the decade than how kids played video games, what they were playing. But, you know, there were still some really interesting things that came out of Atari Inc. as well, or Atari Corp. I keep getting the names all mixed up. It's a lot to keep track of. And I do kind of want to talk about those things because those pieces of hardware, like some of them were really great. And so this brings us back around to the Atari 7800, which was a really strong piece of hardware and was supposed to launch in 1984, where it would have beaten, you know, the Nintendo Entertainment System to the market by a good 2 years, Sega Master System by 2 years. Like, it would have been sort of the first console of that sort of, I guess, you know, second or third wave, however you want to designate that. And it, you know, like, the hardware itself was very competitive and comparable to the NES, but it would have been here a couple of years in advance instead of launching around the same time that the NES went nationwide with a much stronger campaign behind it. I feel like Atari really didn't push the 7800 that hard. They were just kind of like, here's a console that just came out. It doesn't have Mario, but it's Atari. You want that, right?
I mean, Atari Corporation didn't have the kind of, it didn't have Warner money behind it, especially after the whole process of Jack Tramiel having to basically buy the 7800 separately, and he had to pay off General Computing Corporation, who designed it. He had to pay them off again to actually have games for it, and then he had to start rebuilding the development team, because they ended up getting laid off during that whole period of time. So yeah, it got delayed until around May 1986 when they started releasing it. And then by the time it got nationwide, the NES was being sold nationally, and I think the Master System was too. So suddenly you had all this competition, and Nintendo definitely had more advertising dollars behind it.
And even Sega, that was being distributed by Tonka, who, you know, it's a pretty big company. So they pushed it pretty hard. I saw ads. I don't think I ever saw a 7800 commercial on television, ever. I saw ads for Nintendo, for Sega, but not for Atari 7800.
I know they had commercials. I never remember.
I found them on YouTube, and I'm like, where did you people find this stuff? Like, did you go to the Atari archives and find videos that never broadcast? What happened here?
Yeah.
Bob says public access.
Yeah, I don't recall ever seeing any on television. We ended up getting our 7800 when we just went to a store and needed a new system to play 2600 games on, which I think might have been one of their key selling points at the time.
Yeah, the 7800 was a good piece of hardware, and this is kind of why I say Atari got a raw deal, because I feel like that system could have done a lot more. It could have thrived even. It could have been a really strong competitor to the NES. But because of the crash, it ended up being pushed from 1984 to 1986, and there were all those, you know, political and financial maneuverings that went on with it.
And by the time it launched, the exclusives were just really old games, though, right?
Yeah, I mean, it launched with some really, really like high quality conversions of arcade games, but a lot of them were games that people had already played on 2600. Whereas, you know, you looked at Nintendo and Sega, and Nintendo, you know, they had Mario, they had stuff like Excitebike, like games that people hadn't played before, Balloon Fight, you know, things like that. Sega had really great conversions of, you know, for 8-bit hardware of great Sega arcade games. Like, arcade games is what Sega did. And now you could play those games on a home console from the company that made those games. So, you know, stuff like Hang On, that was like really impressive looking. And yeah, so it was really hard for 7800 and its kind of aging ports of Zevius or Galaga or whatever to sort of stand out. Like, those games would come to NES later, but it was just kind of like, here, flesh out your library with these popular arcade games from bygone days. Whereas with 7800, the proposition was, here's what you got. It's these popular arcade games from bygone days.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. But when you think about it, the console was in development in 83 into 84. So those games were actually top tier at that time.
Absolutely.
They were meant to be just introductory games, and it would still have the full development team, library and IP of Atari, the continuing evolving library of Atari, including the arcade games that they had. And the any ones that they would license, or the new ones that the games that they develop, and then all of a sudden that wasn't there. Like you mentioned before, it didn't come with the IP purchase, because GCC, the company that developed it, its contract was with Warner. That's what I said before about this dual management. Warner would go and make deals, and then have Atari execute them. They didn't necessarily order it. That was including the Amiga deal that had happened too. That was with Warner as well. So those did not come with the purchase that Tramiel made. he had to negotiate for him. Like you said, he had to, as far as the 7800, he had to go and he had to pay those things off. By that time, we're talking about the summer of 85. He's looking to start relaunching the 7800. So NES wasn't on any radar yet at that time. And he basically had nothing. So then he's got to get somebody over to start up a games division again. He got Mike Katz, who we interviewed for this show in the past. He came over from Epics. He was over there, and all of a sudden he saw, you know, it's about September into October, and he's going to license games, and he can't, because they're all snapped up by this company called Nintendo that's going to be coming up with this console. So he came up with the idea, okay, I'm going to start licensing titles from that haven't been on consoles before, that have just been on home computers. And so he started bringing those in, but, you know, even then, he didn't really have a home a development team to really speak of. He would outsource a lot of the development for any of the original games that they did, or any of the licensed games like that, too. So there really wasn't anything there. As far as the commercials and marketing, yeah, they had that. I myself saw back in the day the National Video Game Team commercial one that they had, but I didn't see much else. Most of their ads were in like magazines and things like that for the 7800. But again, it was there was no budget. When Tramiel took over the IP and started his new company, he also took over a lot of the debt from the consumer division as well. That came with it. Plus, he had to pay on licenses. Nintendo actually strong-armed Tramiel that summer of 84. Because all the games of Mario for the 5200 and the 2600, the unsold games that came as part of the assets that he was going to sell, they considered that a sale. So they wanted their cut from that. So they strong-armed him for that. You know, just all sorts of stuff that people don't realize that it was a couple years before he could actually have his company in the black and have most of that Warner debt, the old Warner debt paid off, which was insane. I mean, he had to renegotiate with Warner several times, you know, for a better and a better deal because he just couldn't make it on the terms that they had with it. So there wasn't much to speak of until, I'd say, around 87. And by that time, yeah, Nintendo was pretty much the king of it all. So,
yeah, it sounds like kind of a raw deal.
Yeah,
And I'm glad you mentioned Epics because they also are responsible for another really, I think, remarkable piece of hardware that Atari brought out, the Atari Lynx, which began as the Epics Handy, and development on that began in 1986. And Atari ended up taking, you know, kind of possession of that. There were some shenanigans there. It wasn't all necessarily in good faith, I think, just based on different stories that have come out. But, you know, it eventually they released this really great handheld system, full color screen, backlit, apparently, from what I've read, the sprite blitter could process infinite sprites. I'm sure there was some sort of upward limit on it. But basically, like, the system would basically kind of scale and just draw more power to make, you know, all these sprites happen on screen. So very impressive, and completely demolished by Nintendo's Game Boy, which launched about the same time as the Lynx, even though it hadn't been in development as long, or at least not known to have been in development. And again, I feel like, you know, had things, the situation been better for Atari and they had been in a better better space and had better finances, they could have gotten the Lynx out, say, in 1988 instead of 89. And who can say what would have happened if the Atari Lynx had had a year's lead on Nintendo's Game Boy? Like, yeah, Game Boy had Mario and it had Tetris, and those were great. But, you know, if that came out after people had been playing Lynx with its full color screen and really impressive, almost like 16-bit quality visuals in a handheld system for a year, I think Game Boy would have been a much harder sell. But unfortunately, that's not how it worked out for Atari.
Well, it was a cost too, because it was a full color LCD screen in 1989. It was expensive, so it drove up the cost. They had actually tried to negotiate
battery costs also.
The battery costs too. Yes,
they went up there.
Yeah, they had batteries added half the weight of the system, but it was, you know, they had been in negotiations, or they had deals with their suppliers, or that was supposed to drive the cost down further, even after the Lynx too. And it never came. They actually wound up suing them, but then you had basically Nintendo come in with their Game Boy with display technology that was maybe a step above the old calculator technology that handheld games were using before that. And they were able to keep the cost down, and then they had the games people wanted to play. So, I mean, that was pretty much it.
And I I seem to recall reading that there was a parts shortage that Atari claimed was going on with the Lynx 2 around the time it came out. So even if you wanted to get a Lynx in 89, you wouldn't be able to find one until sometime next year. Hey, may as well check out this Game Boy thing. I can find it everywhere on the store shelves.
Yeah, and it looks like we are out of time. And I think we kind of hit all the points we wanted to. There is still like the Atari Jaguar, but I don't know if anyone necessarily wants to try to make a case for that one. So I think we will wrap.
What the?
Oh, there are some fans. Okay, you can talk to Bob about that. Back after the panel. But yeah. Anyway, thanks everyone for coming to this panel. Thank you to Marty and Kevin for your very informed opinions. Hopefully, we have shed a little light into your hearts and made you think, maybe Atari deserved a little better in the late 80s. Maybe they'd still be around if things had gone a little differently. But they didn't, and that's where we are now.